Welcome to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
Cindy, it's a beautiful Sunday.
Oh my gosh, it is amazing.
And we're here in the studio. We're live today on this beautiful Sunday. We're trying not to be resentful.
we
can take your calls, your questions, your emails. You can reach us 410-662-8780 or send us an email, foremanwolf@wypr.org.
Yeah, and we'd love to hear from you today.
Yeah, I mean, it's prime summertime. We're going to spend a little bit of time on summer recipes here in the first segment. Second segment, we have a coffee-oriented guest, Lindsay DeFabio, who's quite the expert.
Right.
To take a lot of coffee
Excited
questions, so you can save those.
Here.
Mm-hmm. And in the third segment, I have a kinder, gentler chef's challenge.
Mm-hmm. So it's not going to have any Oreo cookies on it this time. You did that last week, so you can't do Oreo cookies this time.
Right, it's
or
not
tripe.
It's not as
thankfully that's under our belt. Even though a listener pointed
sometimes,
out that I didn't deal with either one.
That's
of
right,
those.
You didn't deal with either one of those.
Well, you said I could ignore one. I decided to ignore two.
Sorely disappointed. All right, so I woke up this morning thinking about biscuits.
Well,
I woke up
I
yesterday morning
that.
Thinking about biscuits.
Mm-hmm.
And 25 years ago, we opened a restaurant where all I did was drink Coca-Cola and eat biscuits. Would you please tell the world?
Yes.
How is it those biscuits that were made 25 years ago or that you can still make now?
Yeah. Right.
Well, how to make them and why they're so good?
These
are not those leaden, terrible.
That's the whole thing. When you go to make biscuits, I used to use White Lily flour, which is quite frankly part of the key to why those biscuits were so pretty. It's a soft winter wheat flour. It was very hard to get up here. I mean, you're not exaggerating when you say 25 years ago.
So this is you can't use all-purpose flour to make proper biscuits.
You can, but I would suggest if you can get your hands on White Lily flour.
But that's heavy gluten flour, right?
It's
all-purpose.
It
and White Lily is less.
Right. It's a soft winter wheat, so it's just a more delicate flour. It's just going to give you a lighter texture in your biscuits and was always used in the South, or probably still is. And now with the internet and everything, I'm sure it's much easier to get. But I struggled a lot getting some of our purveyors to figure out how to get it, but they did. And one of the things with making a biscuit is when you go to mix the flour and the butter together in the mixer, you do it with a paddle attachment and you do it on low speed. And what happens is that butter, and you want your butter, you know, with all things, pastry, which thank goodness I'm not a pastry chef because I don't have the temperament for it.
No, you don't.
I don't. I like to move fast. I like everything about fast and speed and, you know, and free form. You know, the idea of if I had to follow a recipe every day for everything that I did, I wouldn't be a chef. There's no question. I just like to cook. And but anyway, getting back to the biscuits, I found the other day I was making a different type of dough, and man, my kitchen's hot right now at work, and just that little bit of temperature change in the kitchen, the butter got a little bit too soft. I was making a sablé dough, which sablé means sand in French, and it's a beautiful dough that's crumbly. It kind of melts on your palate because it has a lot of butter in it, and it has cheese in it.
I love sablé, but I don't want to keep you on biscuits.
Right. Well, you know how I am. So,
yeah, so that's why I want to keep you on
I'm getting back
biscuits.
To the point of the fact that your butter temperature is extremely important. So you need the butter to be cool. You don't want it to be soft. If it's so soft that you can like mush it with your hand, that's a culinary term, then you
hand mushable.
then you've got your butter's too soft. So you need to be, it can't be cold because then it won't break up enough to go into the flour. So you just need it to be cool. And so you put it on low speed, break it up into the flour. I don't know what temperature. And then, excuse me. And then you I add buttermilk to my biscuits. And instead of using butter, you could use lard, which is the first biscuits you ever ate that I made. I used lard.
Those are the biscuits I ate when I was a kid, many years.
Was
it either lard or duck fat or butter and duck fat together?
Right, which is the traditional way in the South. And so you could use lard or you could use butter or you could use duck fat, whatever you would like. And then I add buttermilk and eggs and salt and pepper, and that's it. And the other really important aspect of making biscuits is when you do take the dough, so you don't overwork the dough. This is the whole point.
That means you don't mix it for too long.
Yeah, you're not trying to work the strands of the gluten. You're trying to make it form together as quick, as quickly and delicately as possible. And then when you take the dough out of the bowl, we call it turning it out of the bowl, you lay it on a lightly floured, dust your surface with flour. And of course, it's got to be very clean. And just put the dough out. And I actually use my hands to just sort of pat it down. And then I pull out the rolling pin and roll it as little as possible and just roll it out nice and, you know, you want it to be like, 2.5 inches thick, 2 inches thick. And then you can either use a biscuit cutter or we just use our round cutters and you cut it out and you pretty much only get one chance to roll that dough out. So you really want to make use of all the dough. You know, you want to cut right next to the next cut to the next cut so you're not wasting the dough. And then you dock the dough with a fork and you brush it with egg wash, which is a whole egg.
Docking it with a fork means what?
Use a fork to, I don't know how to...
Poke it?
Poke it. All right, that's a word. another fascinating culinary term. And yeah, you poke it with a fork, and that keeps it from bubbling up or rising incorrectly.
Yeah, so it steams out.
It steams out, that's right. And then you make egg wash, which is you just whisk an egg with a little bit of water and just, you know, use your pastry brush. And this is when, actually, it's important not to have too much flour. When you're rolling your dough out, don't, put a ton of flour on it. You want to really lightly dust it with the flour just so that the rolling pin doesn't stick to the dough and that the dough doesn't stick to your surface that you're on. And I actually might take my pastry brush and just kind of dust, and you have to do it really lightly because if you made your dough correctly, it's going to be very gentle or delicate. The dough is going to be delicate, so you need to be gentle with your pastry brush and kind of get some of that excess flour off, then go into your egg wash and brush the top with the egg wash and bake it at 350 degrees for, it depends on the dough. I'd say maybe 8-10 minutes, maybe 12, and it depends on your oven. But biscuits, I haven't made biscuits in a little while. We may have to make some biscuits and put them on the menu.
Do you know why they're on my mind?
Because you like strawberries?
It's because it's time to make preserves.
Yeah, of course. Okay.
So my house, there's all kinds of preserves being made.
Mm-hmm.
There was a great apricot made last week, and all I could think about was...
Mm. You need a biscuit for that apricot preserve.
Yeah, exactly.
That's nice. That's great.
Needs butter, needs biscuits.
I grew up in a family that all the women did a lot of preserving, too. And I don't do it. And we may do a little bit for the restaurant, or the pastry chef may do some for the restaurant. But I really appreciate people that do that, because my aunt would make the best pickles. I couldn't wait to have her pickles. She would make the best jams. My mom would make great jams. She almost always made black raspberry jam, which was absolutely everybody in my family's favorite. Black raspberries are still hard to find. And back then
they're done for the year. So
okay. And but anyway, so yeah, all kinds of preserves are just a wonderful treat in the wintertime.
Yeah. No, now's the time. That's for sure.
Okay. So you have a question?
I have an email.
Okay.
From a listener, from Will in Waverly. I've been trying to meal prep lately to manage my diet and save money, but I'm bored of chicken breasts. Any summary suggestions to vary it up? Trying to keep the lean protein.
Well, and also with keeping costs down, if you eat pork, it is one of the more inexpensive meats that you can work with. Oftentimes with trying to hold costs down, the whole thing is using an offcut of meat if you do want to use something other than chicken.
Yeah, the first thing I see with chicken breasts is like, well, use a thigh.
Yeah.
Get a boneless thigh.
The thigh is my favorite cut on a chicken. I love the thigh. And there's so many things. And that's it. As you said, you can get it either with a bone in. You can get them boneless at the grocery store, which is wonderful. But I like it with a bone in because, as we both know, flavor comes from that. So, but either way, or, you could do so many things. You could, braise it. You can grill it. You can roast it. And right now, this time of the year, I just think it is the most, for me, having worked in professional kitchens for so, so many years and being inside and oftentimes in kitchens where there was not a window in sight, is grilling outside. I love it. It's, and today is a gorgeous day, so I'm absolutely grilling out tonight. excuse me, but the idea of grilling, you're not having a lot of things to clean up, you're all you have to do is brush down a grill when you're done. You can grill your vegetables. You're cooking in very little fat. And it's just, you know, a wonderful fresh way to work. And you can grill your vegetables. You can.
What are you grilling today?
What am I grilling today is I'm going to get a veal tenderloin. I'm going to get lamb rack chops. We'll definitely get a couple of different types. I have a number of people coming over, and some my friend is from Colombia.
I was going to say,
and he's making empanadas and ají. So I'm going to make a wonderful mixed grill of things for everyone to go with the empanadas and the ají.
The companion question to that is, what is your address?
Exactly. The exciting thing about him, and again, this is a little off subject, but he hand grinds his corn for his empanadas. And he showed me a couple of pictures. He has all the guys that work for me from Mexico were completely freaking out when they saw this picture of this grinder that he has. It's just like, oh my gosh, that's what we used at home. This reminds me of my home.
Is it a big mocajete?
No, he uses a grinder. And he was actually grinding the corn. He had it attached to his railing outside. I'm like, only Hector would do that. I love this. So it's a pretty cool device. And but anyway, getting back to grilling, I love a combination of chili powder and Madras curry. And that is a great marinade. If you mix it with a little bit of olive oil and salt and pepper and put it, it's a great marinade for chicken breasts or chicken thighs or pork, quite frankly. It goes really well with both meats.
For lean proteins, I was going to throw in there ground turkey.
Oh, yeah, and pork's
which you can
not
do
a lean.
All kinds of
I
goodies.
Forgot about the lean part. Pork is not lean.
I mean, you can make kebabs with them. You can, you know, you just follow a lamb kebab recipe and use the turkey. You can use turkey for meatballs, sneak a little duck fat in there.
Mm-hmm.
You can use ground turkey for turkey burgers. And that turkey burger is a super neutral thing. As long as you get it nice and crispy, you can dress it with all kinds of goodies.
Yeah.
So those are all, and honestly, fish.
Yeah, and that's what
why not just...
Yeah, just instead of eating chicken, move on to some fish.
Yeah, find reasonable fresh fish.
This is the time of the year.
Yeah,
and
no question.
We have a bunch of good places you can buy fish around here, so that's really, really great.
Okay. All right, let's take a call. We're going to take Matthew. Matthew, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm looking at making some lamb bacon, and I had a couple of questions. The first one is I've done some looking on the internet, and the cut that's recommended is called lamb belly. My butcher is not a native English speaker. He's not familiar with the term. I think that boneless lamb breast and lamb belly are the same thing. Is that correct?
No. That's definitely not correct.
No, lamb belly is one of the best things to cook in the entire world, to my taste.
I agree.
But you can definitely make bacon with it, too.
Mm-hmm. So you just need to cure it.
There's just more fat on the belly, and that's part of what you want for cure.
You're on the right track with the lamb belly, for sure.
If you cure something that's totally lean, like lamb breast, you're going to get really like hard, gritty bacon. You need some fat, especially when it cooks. It wants some fat. It's one of the nice things about duck bacon.
Mm. Okay, is there another name for lamb belly then?
No, you've got it right.
Not in English.
Yeah, you've got it right.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay, so I guess I'll just need to check it out to him and make sure that it's from the normally kosher part of the lamb. And my other question was, when curing it, I've seen two ways of doing it. One is, and this is both done in the fridge, is that you put on the cure and you wrap it in like saran wrap and let it cure that way. And the other way is that you put in the cure and you like put it on a rack and let the juices drain out. And I was wondering which one was better.
I vote for put it on a rack and let the juices drain out. Definitely. Yeah, you want that process to, part of the process of curing is removing moisture and preserving. And that's why I would suggest putting it on the rack and letting it drain away. Awesome.
You also want to be patient with it. I mean, that's a lot of times people make bacon at home and they get itchy and they end up consuming it early and the texture's not very nice.
Yeah, give it some time.
Yeah.
Have fun.
Okay,
that's great. You're ambitious. That's cool. I like it.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Matthew.
All right. Nice.
When we come back on Farmer the Wolf on Food and Wine, we'll take more of your calls, 410-662-8780. Or send us an email, foremanwolf@wypr.org. We have Lindsay DeFabio coming up to have a coffee talk. And then, of course, the Chef's Challenge in a bit. All of that and more on Foreman Wolf on Food & Wine on WYPR. Welcome to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
Cindy, I've got a couple of listener emails.
Good.
To get into with a couple of questions. This is from John in Ellicott City. Help! I have there's a lot of A's in there, way too many plums already this year.
Oh, yeah, so do I.
It's a good problem to have for sure, but I was wondering if you had any suggestions for savory recipes using plums.
I'm using mine right now with pan-seared foie gras, and I realize
that he
might not be able to do that, but any sort of bird.
Plums are great for duck.
Plums and birds, yeah, duck. Quail, pheasant, guinea fowl, anything. Oh my goodness. And they're so good. We have these. What are the little tiny ones called?
Methley. Little red ones.
Oh my gosh.
First of all,
eat a whole bunch of them because when I'm working with them, I can't stop eating them. They're so good.
I tell you what, they do make also a pretty darn nice variation on caprese, mm-hmm. where you have fresh mozzarella and tomato typically and basil. Go ahead and use the plums. And you can use balsamico with that. It's quite mm-hmm. nice. Fresh
Yummy.
Mint with that is quite nice.
That sounds good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yes,
arugula.
You do salt the plums a little bit.
You can put arugula
bit.
In there. That would be delicious.
Yeah, you need arugula instead of the mint.
Yeah. All right.
So that's that's that one. And then we've got Jude in Annapolis. My birthday's in the summertime. My grandmother would make her lemon meringue pie for it every year. Hmm. It was my favorite part of my birthday and was always so delicious. Sweet and tart, lemon filling, and light as a cloud meringue on top.
Nice.
It was the perfect sweet treat for a hot summer day. I cannot bake.
Uh-oh.
And tricks, how about any tricks or tips for a lemon filling or a fluffy meringue?
Fluffy meringue. One of the things about making a meringue is your mixing bowl and your whisk need to be perfectly clean. Egg whites will not whisk to their stiff peaks as well as they should if there is any fat is its enemy, which is and the other thing is when you break the yolks from the whites, you cannot have any because the yolk is protein is the enemy you can't have any of the yolk in the white. So first you have to start off by breaking those eggs perfectly. And I would break one at a time over its own bowl so that you don't ruin the egg whites that you already have going. And the other thing is I always wipe out my bowl with vinegar, and that makes the bowl perfectly clean and the whisk as well. And then you whisk to stiff peaks with sugar. We call it showering the sugar into the egg whites. So you shower, like throwing it in. Like a shower.
Listeners cannot see the hand motions on the radio.
Yeah, I know. Well, you know what I mean. And so, therefore, you make the whites.
Basically, it's Cindy doing kung fu with sugar at a 45-degree angle.
And the lemon curd part, I don't know what to tell you about that. All you have to do is follow a recipe for that. And as far as making the tart dough, again, it kind of comes down to
biscuit. What kind of tart do you want to make?
Right. If you want it to be a beautiful dough, you just, again, don't overwork the process.
If you can't bake and you want to cheat, make a graham cracker crust.
Ooh, yeah. There's that. But that's not what he's looking for.
Maybe they're looking for something new.
You need a sweet tart dough recipe. Okay.
So you can reach us. We're live today, 410-662-8780. If you have any questions, emails foremanwolf@wypr.org. And we have a guest, and now's the time to go for it with your coffee questions. We have Lindsay DeFabio with us today.
Hi, Lindsay. Thanks for being with us today.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
Lindsay describes herself as living the barista dream.
I know. It's true.
I'd met her over the years in a number of places around town. She worked with us for a bit and is the most knowledgeable person about coffee and the most passionate person about coffee that I'm in contact with. So we wanted to bring her on for questions.
Well, thanks.
So what kind of coffee do you drink? Worst question ever, right?
It is the worst question ever. If I'm at home, lately I've just kind of been scrambling a lot in the morning. I have a hard time being organized. It's a plague among artists and baristas. I'll just make a French press. It's easy. It's quick. If I go out and I go to a cafe that I enjoy, I'm almost exclusively just going to have one pull of espresso and some sparkling water. Hmm. They're opposite drinks, but those are like the two things I'll stick to the most.
Hmm. I remember when I was younger and I could do that. So, all right. So the people that go into a jazzy coffee shop, right? I can't be the only person that feels judged by the person behind the counter.
Well, your hair is really great, so they're not judging you.
No, they're definitely judging. They're judging what I order, aren't they?
Not necessarily.
Oh, that's awesome.
I mean, but seriously.
I'm great.
Okay, so look, I live in the same bad place that many people do. I take medication and I have to drink decaf. Is my life over?
No. No, your life's not over. There's a couple beliefs about coffee and why people enjoy it. Some people believe you have coffee because you like the caffeine and you like to be pumped up. And it's a thing to help you get you through your day.
Keep that away from Cindy, please.
I had two cups this morning. And just thinking about you, and I know what Tony, I almost walked in and said, Tony, I had two cups of coffee because it makes him crazy, because it makes me crazy. Coffee makes me crazy, but I love it. I love it, love it, love it. But I'm already hyper. So you add two cups of coffee to that, and it's like, woo!
Some people have coffee because they like how it tastes. They like the notes in a nice single origin coffee, or they like an espresso. And other people have coffee, and I think this is what most people do when they have coffee, is because they like the quiet time. They like the ceremony of just sitting by themselves and pouring their milk in, and if they like their milk, and just reflect on their day and have a chill couple moments to yourself where you just got a cozy drink and a little time to collect yourself. And there's, you know, if that's you, there's no reason that decaf should hinder your day at all.
But what about the barista and their judgment?
Well, if that's their deal, they suck.
Oh. Wow, that's pretty direct.
No one should, in my opinion, judge anyone
for any reason.
For something as simple as their choice of beverage when they want something warm and cozy. That's absolutely preposterous.
Good. Yeah, I'm with you on that, but you know, you have feelings about these things.
I have strong
feelings.
So
you mentioned single origin coffee. Mm-hmm. So can you describe what single origin, what does that mean?
I would love to tell you about single origin coffee. So there's two types of coffee you're going to find in the store. You're going to find a single origin coffee, which is exactly what it sounds like. Every bean in that bag is from the same place. Pretty much always the same farm, not necessarily, but the same region and area.
So it could be from Glen Burnie, could be from
In this
Maryland.
Country, it could only be from could Hawaii, be. Because that's the only state in the United States where coffee is
grown. Yeah, so where are good places to get single origin coffee from?
It depends on your tastes. I personally lean towards a lot of Ethiopian coffees. I like a coffee that's a little fruitier and tends to have, you know, a little higher acidity or a brighter body. Other people like coffee that's like very smooth and silky and a little more subdued. You're going to get a lot of that in like Central and South American coffees. There's always exceptions, but as a general rule, if you want something like soft and mellow, something from Brazil is probably going to be like right up your alley. And that's what a lot of people like. And that's a major export of that country. It's very easy to find Brazilian coffee in America.
What's the craziest, priciest, you know, single origin that it's just the show off coffee?
I mean, people always talk about Kopi Luwak, which is a coffee that I refuse to drink for a lot of reasons. It's if you haven't heard about it, it's the famous cat poop coffee. Uh-huh. You feed coffee cherries to an animal and they poop it out and then you roast the seeds. I think that's dumb.
I read about that this morning. I was kind of horrified.
That sounds a bit unattractive.
Yeah. And honestly, you know, I had a coffee, gosh, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago that stands out as one of the best coffees I've ever had in my life ever. It came from Panama, and it was this really just bananas natural process geisha, which is a varietal. The beans were really, really big. They were like just soft, beautiful beans, and they were kind of red in color because of the way they'd been processed. A lot of the essence of the fruit of the coffee seeped into the seed, which is what you make your beverage out of. And the closest thing I can think of is it was like drinking hot Kool-Aid. It just was fruity and it was sweet and it was delicious. I just wanted to drink it forever, but I couldn't because the 8-ounce bag I bought was like $68.
Oh, wow. Interesting.
Oh, that is show off coffee.
Yeah, and I zero regrets at all about buying it at all. I would do it again.
$68 well spent.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah,
there
you go. I haven't met a coffee quite like that one since. That was just a really remarkable harvest.
Very cool.
All right. So how about judgment? I'm going back to judge. I'm sorry. I grew up Catholic. That's the way it goes. People that like cream and sugar in their coffee.
It's totally fine. You should have what you like to have. And here's an interesting thing about
people
permissive. who who customarily drink their coffee with cream and sugar, your palate learns to accept cream and sugar, and it's not going to hinder you tasting what's going on in your coffee. You're going to have a different coffee than you've had before, but you're going to put your milk and sugar in it like you're used to, and you're just going to taste around that, and you'll still be able to pick out the notes that are impressive about that bean.
That's awesome. I love that. So, I also understand that when you add dairy product to your coffee, it is absorbed slower, and you don't get the effect from the caffeine as much.
Yeah, that people like to put butter in their coffee. Ooh. They like to mess around with
buttered coffee,
putting fats in their coffee to experiment with like how the caffeine hits you. Mm-hmm. I think if you just drink your coffee at a certain pace, you really don't need to worry about that. But
that's
why
it's so much safer to live in decaf land.
Yeah.
So okay, so people brew pots of coffee at home. What do they have to do to brew a really good pot of coffee at home? Because that's largely what people do. They have a coffee maker. Mm-hmm. And
I would suggest if anybody
are there gadgets? Is there a technique?
Yeah, if anyone was in the market for some coffee gadgets, I like I just said, I've been doing a lot of French press at home just because it's quick and easy. There's also some pour over methods where you just have a kettle of hot water. You're going to pour over your coffee grinds. I like the Chemex pot. It's kind of been an American staple since about the 60s. I like it because it creates the fewest amount of like dishes. You've got your coffee carafe and the thing that holds your coffee grinds and your filter all in one. Whatever is more towards your personal taste, a French press coffee is going to have more oils in it. It's going to have some sediment. A Chemex or any other pour over is probably going to be very clean, very crisp. I would suggest getting an electric kettle with a pouring spout. It just makes things wildly easier. And they're not really that expensive or hard to find. And if you want to be a little more particular about it, a gram scale is really great, roughly. Yeah. A little under 2 grams of coffee grinds per ounce of water you're going to use. So if you have a 12-ounce mug, you're going to use 20-ish grams of coffee.
Oh, that's good to know.
And you know, as long as you've got a ratio that's pretty consistent, your coffee is going to turn out pretty good. I think eyeballing coffee is one of the harder things to do and get a quality drink.
I have an excellent question from a listener who has a position. This is Joey in Essex. I just don't like iced coffee. For me, coffee is by definition a hot drink. Its energizing and rejuvenating effects are directly linked to it being a hot, get-you-going drink. When it's a balmy 100 degrees in Maryland and I order hot coffee, my girlfriend thinks I've lost my mind. What are your thoughts on iced coffee?
Oh, I don't think you've lost your mind. Like I said, people like what they like. I personally love iced coffee. Here's a fun sciencey tidbit about coffee. The caffeine content in your coffee is directly correlated to how long your coffee grinds are in contact with the water. So if you bought at a store a cold brew coffee takes anywhere between 12 and 24 hours to brew, depending on the person who's making it and their ratios and what have you. It is going to be probably the most caffeinated coffee you really get in a serving, unless you're going out of your way to make something that's just, you know, really, really, really strong. Like if you just put a whole bunch of espresso in a cup, it'll probably be more caffeinated than a glass of cold brew. But, you know.
So cold brew and iced coffee are two different things.
It's just a method of iced coffee. If you make your coffee in the cold brew method, your coffee is never really hot, and you're not going to get any flavor damage that's associated with the temperature shock. It's not going to get watered down like pouring hot coffee over ice cubes. So your mouthfeel and your consistency are all going to be a lot better. I don't really recommend pouring hot coffee over ice because it's going to get watery and the flavor is not going to be as good for multiple reasons. Cold brew coffee has become pretty popular. I see it in every grocery store, and all you need to make it at home is basically a jar and a filter. You just put your coffee grinds and your water together, leave them on your counter, leave them in your fridge overnight and strain it. And there's a lot of people who debate about your ratios and what have you, but you can experiment with it. And cold brew is a very forgiving method. So, you know, you've got room to play and have something that still tastes pretty good.
So I remember one of the things when you first came to the restaurant to help the waiters was you showed them how to do the steamed milk for the cappuccino.
Mm-hmm.
Would you go over?
Because
you do that so beautifully.
Thank you.
And can you tell them how to do that?
Yeah, and maybe you can tell listeners steam milk for what is it different for latte? Is it different for
sure.
cappuccino? Is it different for macchiato?
I have a lot of feelings on milk.
Wow, it's feelings on Formula Wolf on Food and Wine Live today. 410-662-8780.
Let's have it.
Full disclosure, I am a lactose intolerant person.
Oh my gosh.
So I have an inherent bias about milk where I think it's icky. So I put extra effort in a beverage that has milk because I have to think, how is this not going to be icky? It can't be icky anymore. And getting over that hurdle was a little bit of a thing for me, but I think it's what forced me to put the effort into really paying attention to milk, and that's important. So lactose, the thing I'm allergic to, is milk sugar. And like any other sugar, it's sweet, but only when presented a certain way. A cow is not 38 degrees. So when you have your cold milk in a glass, it doesn't taste anything like nature really intended milk to taste like. And what happens is the milk sugars get kind of like, they just kind of bind up and you can't get it on your palate. You just don't taste it at all. When you warm up your milk and you get closer to a body temperature, you're more the way that milk was intended to be, which is the tastiest way for it to be. A cow is, you know, a little warmer than a human. Once you get to around 100 degrees for the temperature of your milk, that sweetness starts to be perceivable on the palate.
Yeah. To be an expert on coffee, you have to know the difference in temperature between humans and cows?
Apparently.
It's beneficial.
It's awesome.
So once your milk starts to get warm, that sweetness starts to come out. And there's a window where that sweetness is really the best. And that's the window where milk for your coffee drink should be. I think once you get about 150 plus degrees, that sweetness starts to burn off. People in America specifically really love hot coffee, and they'll request lattes or cappuccinos to be very hot all the time.
I can't do that.
Nearly without fail, when I'm working on coffee bar, if someone asks for a extra hot coffee drink, they'll end up dumping a bunch of sugar in it. And it, you know, it amuses me because I had just burned off all the sugar that was naturally in that drink because it was already in the milk. Paying attention to the temperature of the milk in your beverage is wildly important when you're steaming your milk.
That's one of the reasons we first got along.
It sure is. Tony likes his drinks at like optimum milk sweetness, which I think is really around 125, 130.
I have a sweet tooth. I'm a little kid.
It's tasty.
Anyway, we're going to have to say goodbye.
Oh.
It was cool to have you on.
Hey, thanks.
Oh, yeah. Thanks
for
being here.
We'll have to have you back for more coffee expertise.
That'd be great.
And things like the difference in temperature between cows and humans.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, when we come back on Formula Wolf on Food and Wine, we've got callers on the line. You can reach us 410-662-8780 or email us formanwolf@wypr.org. I've got a few emails to get to. And then we've got a little more summer food to talk about. And then we're going to get into a kinder, gentler chef's challenge. All of that and more on Formula Wolf on Food and Wine on WYPR. Welcome to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And we're live today taking your calls, 410-662-8780, or email us, foremanwolf@wypr.org. We've got a little more summer food to talk about, but first let's take a call that's right on target from George in Pasadena. George.
Hi, George.
Go ahead.
Hi there. Hey, I wanted to share some information with all the frustrated gardeners out there who have had a bunch of ripening tomatoes that before picking get ruined by squirrels or birds or groundhogs or whatever. And I had heard several years ago from a reliable source that you can pick tomatoes once they start to show color. So whenever it just turns pink from the green, that you could bring them inside, put them on a counter, and they'll ripen and be just as good as if you waited until that day that they ripen on the vine. And since I had always abhorred those greenhouse tomatoes that are picked green and then are ripened by ethylene gas, I figured, well, it's too good to be true. But just in the last week, because I was having a problem with squirrels and ruining my tomatoes, that I confirmed with the Extension Service HGIC people, they said that you absolutely is true. You don't have to wait. And further, they say that you do not compromise the flavor. So just I don't have the guts to do it immediately when they turn pink, but I wait until they're at least orange. And then I've been, and typically the squirrels don't go after them until they're further along. And, you know, I think what they're saying is true. So just, and they're obviously, once you pick them and brought them in, you don't have to water the, if they're the last ones in the plant, you won't have to water the plant. That's... Just forget it. But anyway, it's a, just something that I think there's so many tomato growers out there, and I figure there's some of them that haven't heard this.
Well, that's nice of you to share that tip, George.
Thank you, George. We appreciate it.
Okay. You're welcome.
And hope it goes well. You know, and also, if you want to pick those tomatoes while they're green, you can fry them. And I do very simply a nice thick slice, not too thick, cornmeal, a little bit of cayenne pepper. And when they come out of, you can either saute them or fry them on the stove in corn oil or canola oil, your choice. Then I lightly dust them with salt and do a million different things with them. So we can
also use
the green
tomatoes.
With them. What's that?
On Sunday around this time. Mm-hmm. Is Eggs Benedict on top of those green tomatoes.
That sounds good.
You can toss a couple of pickled jalapenos on top of that.
That sounds really good.
You have a good situation.
All right. Yeah.
Maybe not one that's coffee friendly.
No.
But maybe you've already had your coffee.
All right.
So we have an email that I do not know if we can help with.
Okay.
Unless you have knowledge that I'm not aware of. Dear Chef and Tony, this is from Patrick in Austin, Texas. My wife and I moved to Texas a few years ago, and we've encountered lots of new foods in Mexican grocery stores. There's a lot of cactus on sale, and I've tried cooking it a few times without success. What is the best way to cook cactus?
Yeah, that I can't. I've never eaten cactus or cooked it or seen it to cook it. So I really am sorry, I can't.
It's outside of my knowledge as well. So
amazing question, though.
Yeah, if there is...
That makes me want to find out how to cook cactus.
Yeah, if there's someone, someone with knowledge and experience out there on cooking cactus, shoot us an email, foremanwolf@wyrpr.org.
Or call in.
Or, yeah, give us a call, 410-662-8780.
Have you ever heard of anybody eating cactus before?
Yeah.
Okay, that's cool.
I haven't dealt with it.
Yeah, me either.
I mean, I went to college in Texas, and I didn't see it, so...
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right. Cool. So, Tony, I have a question, a little off topic, but I think it goes with summer wines. The Amarone, can we talk about what that is and why it's so expensive and where it's from and everything?
Okay. Amarone is kind of the opposite of a summer wine.
Okay. Amarone, nice transition for me.
So, yeah, that was a smooth segue. So Amarone is this great, big, rich, thick, red with a lot of sucrosity that's mostly from the Corvina grape that coming from grapes that are dried in the Valpolicella area of northeast Italy, up not that far from Lake Garda.
Oh, great.
Very close to the zone where Suave and Suave Classico are grown, the Garganica white. It is pretty expensive. It's expensive because if you took all of your product and you made half of the wine from it that you would like to, you're going to have to charge more, right?
Sure.
And it's a longer process, and it's more labor-intensive, so it's going to end up being pricier. It is honestly, to me, the flavor is so sweet-seeming, it's a lot for most cooking. If you have really rich stuff in the wintertime, things with a lot of sort of almost like baking spices to it or braised foods, it can do very well. With some blue cheeses like Gorgonzola, it can be really attractive.
Yum.
But and nut dishes and that sort of a thing. The wines from Valpolicella Superiore, and ripassos, which are made from the same Corvina grape, usually in rondinella, that have passed through those skins from Amarone grapes the second time to get a little bit of a seasoning from them. Those are much less money, a little bit lighter, and much easier food matching. Mm-hmm. And you could even possibly match them with, you know, say, grilling pork or duck or...
So we could drink it in the summertime, but you don't think of it as a summertime one.
Amarone you don't think of, but Valpolicella could do it.
Okay.
And as promised, I have a kindler, gentler chef's challenge for you.
Okay, all right, here we go. Home kitchen, all right.
So it's your home kitchen.
Buffalo mozzarella.
No crazy conditions.
Blackberries, spearmint, balsamico, 30-year pancetta, Yukon gold potatoes, sweet onions.
Hang on. That's 30-year balsamico, not 30-year pancetta.
30-year balsamico, I thought that's what I said. Sweet white onion, garlic, salmon fillets, heirloom tomato, green tomato, fresh something, polenta. Dairy, all dairy, extra virgin olive oil, lemons, oranges, chioga beets, big spicy arugula, home kitchen.
My name is not Julie, by the way. They call me Tony.
I don't even
sometimes.
Know where that came from. Just a moment of craziness. The salmon fillets. Oh, well, you know, you've gone and given me green tomatoes.
I've given you
Green tomatoes, I'm going to go ahead and fry them. So since you've given me polenta, I'll cook the polenta very slowly with a little bit of cream and salt, and that's going to lay out on the bottom of the plate. I'm going to garnish that with fried green tomatoes, and I just talked about it, so I don't need to say it again. The salmon fillets, I'm going to grill because I want to be outside, so I'm going to dust them with a little bit of saffron powder, extra virgin olive oil, salt and pepper, and grill them to medium rare because that's the way I like to eat them. And that will be with a little bit of extra virgin olive oil over it, a little bit of lemon in that extra virgin olive oil, and actually I'll use your oranges in there too. So that will be the little bit of marinade for the salmon. And then I will make a salad with a buffalo mozzarella, some of the blackberries. I definitely will use the balsamico. And I'll crisp up the pancetta and add that to the salad with extra virgin, that balsamico. And the accompaniment, I'll also do another salad sort of as an accompaniment for the salmon with the Yukon gold potatoes. I'll boil them, I'll slice them, and do a really quick grill on thinly sliced sweet onion that you gave me. Basically butter poach a little bit of garlic, finish those potatoes with sort of stack the potatoes with the onions and a little bit of the butter poach garlic. What am I missing here? And then I'll roast the chioga beets and actually add that to that. So you're just going to have this gorgeous, wonderful accompaniment to the salmon. The arugula will also be on that buffalo mozzarella salad. And I used everything. There you go. Tony, your turn.
See, what a nice list.
That was a nice list.
You know, I was thinking
that's
as
awesome.
You were talking about that dish,
no Oreo cookies,
that
Tony.
Salmon dish.
Yes.
As much as people love West Coast Pinot Noir, like Sonoma Coast Pinot Noir, that has a little bit of thyme and new oak, that is a perfect dish.
Very good.
For that kind of light red.
Okay, cool.
All right. There's a frowny face on my list here. So sweet. All right. Sweetbreads. I thought I said peanuts. Sweetbreads, peaches, octopus, garlic, shallot, onion, extra virgin olive oil, basil, parsley, bacon, maitake mushrooms, grits, milk, chicken stock, celery, carrots, white wine, eggs, purslane. I don't like purslane. It looks cute, but it's hard to chew. Heirloom tomato, zucchini. Okay.
That's a lot of stuff.
It is, and a varied lot of frowny face stuff. All right. It's funny. The first thing that jumps out to me is to make a comfort dish with the grits, almost like a side dish. I crisp up the bacon and the fat, cook the maitake mushrooms, add a little bit of butter to that fat as well to finish those guys. And I would serve the grits cooked with milk and butter. And serve the grits with the mushrooms cooked in the bacon fat. Mm-hmm. That would be pretty fun.
That sounds good.
What else? Let's do a little zucchini carpaccio on a plate. You're giving me no cheese, but that's okay. Zucchini carpaccio with decent salt, maybe a little tiny bit of sugar. Lots of fresh chopped basil on those heirloom tomatoes. That's a fun salad. Honestly, you gave me peaches, and the peaches can go right in there, too. Mm-hmm. Now, here's the sort of tricky thing. I've got sweetbreads to work with. Sweetbreads, celery, and carrots are the only vegetables I've got to fool around with here. And I've got eggs. Well, honestly, a poached egg on top of that dish with the grits, that would be pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I would like that. Nice runny egg to kind of make sauce for that.
You can always just add the sweetbreads to the grits dish, too, quite frankly. That would be pretty good if you grilled them.
You could grill the sweetbreads and add that, and then put the poached egg on top of
that.
That
would be really good, actually. That would be a good breakfast dish, or brunch dish, I guess I should say.
I would love to eat that for brunch, frankly. Cardiologist's choice. The poached egg on a sweet bread.
Put the little heart next to it on your menu.
That bacon-rich mushroom grit business. All right, yeah. Put the heart like in a round circle with a line through it.
To it, and the cardiologist will say no.
No, okay. The octopus, I kind of had not a lot to work with.
Well, that's kind of why I gave you the carrots and the celery so you could
I can poach the octopus and then grill the octopus. I mean, there's white wine, there's carrots, there's celery. It's not chicken stock that I want, but... It's funny, the chicken stock would be the only thing I don't really use. The purslane, I'm going to give the purslane to someone because I don't want to eat purslane. It's cute. It's one of those things that you see at the market that you're like, what in the, this is so cute, I have to buy it. And then you put it in your mouth and you're not happy about it. So I apologize to the purslane growers of America for my my negative talk.
Did you do it? Is that everything?
Well, I would like something to serve with, lemon. I guess the herbs, something. Yeah, I would like a lemon.
Didn't I give you herbs? I thought I gave you basil and parsley.
You gave me basil and parsley, and I can chop those guys. Those guys
this is like pulling
with
teeth,
lemon
this
and extra virgin olive oil.
What is happening here, Tony Foreman? I think this was the difficult chef challenge.
Well, you did put a frowny face on it.
A week.
So, all right.
Oh, do I sound That's gleeful? Reasonable. I don't know.
Yeah, you do. I'm trying to think of what wine would actually. Get you through that sweet bread with a poached egg on top of the bacon and mushroom
grits. That's my favorite part of your chef's challenge. I may have to make that dish.
All right. I guess, honestly, maybe a glass of champagne is one of the only ways you could actually deal with that. So, well, thanks for listening. If you want to download this program or any other, you can look for our podcasts on the WYPR website, WYPR.org. Go to the Foreman Wolf page. If you have emails still, you can send them to us, foremanwolf@wypr.org. If you want to follow Cindy Wolf on social media,
you can follow me on Instagram as Chef Wolf or on Twitter as Chef Cindy Wolf.
And you can check out my Instagram, The Real Tony Foreman. And I want to say thanks to Luke Spignall, who's our producer and engineer.
Super cool guy.
And Big William, who's got the phones.
William.
And thanks so much for listening.
Happy Sunday.